Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Thank you for joining us again this week for another excellent and important episode of Anthologies of Hope. As always, I am your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. This week, we have June's live recording of the Conversations Cafe event, recorded this past week at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar, right here in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. Next week, we will be back with the second half of our Sip of Hope one-year anniversary extravaganza. It's taken a little longer to get to you than we wanted, but fighting through some wicked summer colds will make it all worth it. We'll also have all the details for upcoming Anthologies of Hope Season 3 plans, which will start in the fall. Just in time to close out the celebration of Pride throughout the month of June, and going up the same day as Chicago's 50th annual Pride Parade, this week's episode is titled Conversations Cafe, Living Out Loud, Celebrating the Power and History of Pride. This episode is in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, dedicated to celebrating the power and history of Pride. We will be using pieces of art to start these important conversations about the origins of Pride, mental health, and the intersection of gender, identity, and orientation, as well as how to advocate and be an ally of the LGBTQ+ community. The art pieces we shared during the live event can be found at anthologiesofhope.com/pride, as well as linked from the episode page on our website. Our excellent guest panelists this week included Dr. Ashley Mullen, Gracie Fisher, and Crystal Basden. Dr. Ashley Mullen is a licensed clinical psychologist and associate director of behavioral health at Center on Halsted, the Midwest's largest and most comprehensive LGBTQ+ community center, and speaks to us tonight on the important intersection of mental health and the LGBTQ+ identity. Gracie Fisher is a student at the University of Illinois Chicago and a Hope for the Day surrogate and member of the Hope for the Day education team. Gracie handles our discussion on the breadth of the LGBTQ+ identity spectrum and the importance of agency, open dialogue, and stigma breaking associated with it. Crystal Basden joins us from the Be Super Initiative. I worked with Crystal earlier this year, gathering some audio at C2E2 for some of the Hope for the Day, Anthologies of Hope, and Be Super collaborations, so it was awesome to see her again. The Be Super Initiative's mission is to bring to life the heroism within all people by using comic book characters as educational tools to understand social justice issues and promoting that every individual is indeed a hero. You can find Be Super on Instagram as Be Super Initiative, all one word, no punctuation, and the rest of their socials in the episode link on our website. Also, a special thanks to our partner in prevention, Busy Beaver Button Company, who gave participants the opportunity to take part in a special art engagement, creating their own buttons to celebrate the stigmatized parts of our own individual identities, be it gay, trans, non-binary, immigrant, or suicide survivor. If you are a local and frequent Sip of Hope, be sure to keep an eye out for these wonderful buttons and expressions displayed on the wall of the coffee shop, adorning a very artfully rustic dark matter coffee burlap bag. As always, Conversations Cafe is a monthly live podcast recording at the Sip of Hope Coffee Bar, featuring education and open forum dialogue on the intersections of mental health within our communities on a variety of rotating topics. This education programming is brought to you by Hope for the Day, with support from Partners in Prevention, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention of Illinois, and Banyan Treatment Centers. For future installments of Conversations Cafes, check out peervention.org or Hope for the Day's or SIP Facebook pages for more details and notifications when new events are listed. As always, our regular episodic Spotify playlists are updated and curated with weekly contributions from guests and myself, can be found at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-2 and anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1, or by searching for our user account on Spotify. As a special bonus for this week's episode, we have a curated playlist that was used for the Pride-focused Conversations Cafe event put together by Gracie and played in the background at Sip of Hope while we recorded the episode. You can check out this excellent musical edition at anthologiesofhope.com/pride-playlist. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you are in a time of crisis, we will be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Hope for the Day and To Write Love in Our Arms. Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help, and To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. And let us know if there's any other platforms you are currently finding podcasts on that you would like us to be on. With that, thank you to everyone who came out, celebrated, and created a button to take home with them this past week. And thank you to all of our listeners celebrating Pride in your own unique ways. We'll jump right into this week's episode, Conversations Cafe, Living Out Loud, Celebrating the Power and History of Pride.
Everyone. Welcome to another episode of Conversations Cafe. My name is Carl Evans. I'm Director of Programs and Operations for Hope of the Day. Conversations Cafe is presented by Hope of the Day
in partnership with AFSP, Banyan Treatment Center, Dark Matter Coffee, and hosted here at the beautiful, lovely Sip of Hope Coffee Bar, the world's first coffee bar where 100% of the net proceeds go to support proactive suicide prevention. And we have a wonderful special show for you tonight. This episode is called Living Out Loud, Celebrating the History and Power of Pride. We have three special guests for you tonight. We're going to be going through a special presentation when we talk about the intersection of identity and orientation. This conversation is part of Hope of the Day's every month, every year, every time we do education, we want to make sure that we're creating a big tent where we want every voice represented in the room. However, it's important to also make sure that we create spaces to explore the nuances within different intersections on mental health. We want to afford that agency to individuals to decide when they want to create spaces for these special nuances. And this is different from the sort of traditional institutional approach to talking about mental health in compartments and at the institutional level, telling people you go into this corner and you go into that corner and you go into this corner. Over the day's approach to practice suicide, making sure everyone's voices are heard, and then let agency decide if people want to create a special space to talk about different nuances with intersections of mental health. And so tonight is one of those times, and we're going to be focusing on pride and what that means in terms of both when we talk about sexual orientation and gender identity, this isn't just going to be a dry brass and tacks facts and what do the terms mean. We wanted to explore really the history of pride and create a context for understanding why we both mark out a special month and there's parades and things like that, but also talk about the importance of the ongoing movement for visibility, that this isn't a one and done or we just needed to have one sort of parade, but this is a conversation that should be explored every year round. So to begin, we thought one of the more interesting things to do when we were putting this program together was we started from looking at the Webster's Dictionary definition of the term pride, because I thought it would be very relevant to start there. We got a little digital screen for those in-house tonight. And if you look at the Webster's Dictionary definition of pride, it goes confidence and self-respect as expressed by members of a group, typically one that has been socially marginalized on the basis of the shared identity, culture, and experience. And that feels a very important thing to conceptualize, because 2019 marks the 50-year anniversary of what would be called the modern gay rights movement and the 50-year anniversary of pride as a concept, pride parades and pride as a concept. But before we jump into where we mark the 50 years forward, I think it's important to also understand what's the difference or shift and why do we mark from 50 years forward. It's not like sexual orientation and gender identity just started in 1969, okay, despite what some people might insist. A little known fact is that in America, the very first formally recognized sort of gay rights organization was actually founded here in Chicago in 1924 by an individual named Henry Baker. And I wanted to bring up this point because it actually creates a perfect distinction for why we honor Pride and the modern gay rights movement. Henry Baker was a German immigrant who emigrated here to America in 1913. Came to Chicago with his family, and by 1917, his family actually institutionalized them for what they called indecent or immoral behaviors, which was code words for homosexual behavior. Well, Henry stayed institutionalized until he volunteered to enlist in the military for World War I. Then they released him out because they thought, you're gonna go be a man. So he went off to fight for his country. And afterwards, after the closing of World War I, Henry stayed on with the American Armed Forces as part of the occupational forces in Germany. And there, Henry discovered what would have been then called the Berlin gay subculture. And there was an academic movement that was fostered out of the Berlin subculture scene that tried to create an academic-based movement for gay rights. Because in Berlin, like a number of other places all over the world, there were, at minimum, repressive laws that banned things like sodomy behavior, all the way down to regulating that women could only wear X amount of pieces of clothing that were male, considered male clothing, before they could be arrested too. Those kind of laws existed in America, for instance, in Illinois, all the way up until 1962, that if a woman was wearing what were deemed as male slacks, a male shirt, a male hat, you could be arrested for a misdemeanor for misrepresenting yourself and your gender. So Henry Baker was influenced by this academic movement and came back to America, and in 1923, submitted paper documentation with a coalition of gentlemen to found the American Society for Human Rights. And this is recognized as the first gay rights association in America. The organization existed for roughly 6 to 7 months before it was shut down when individuals, specifically one of the founding members' wives, narked on them and said that the organization were doing satanic rituals and were exposing children to watching homosexual acts. So the leading board members and named executives were all arrested and rounded up, and the organization was shut down. Got a little picture here of where the actual organization, come on back. Actually was organized at basically, if you go to North and Clark, there's the building, that's a current picture of the building where the society was housed. Why we bring this up though isn't to just have an extended history lesson, but to explain that what Henry Baker did would also join a number of other organizations over the next 20 years that would follow a very specific line of thinking about how to push for gay rights that was fostered in Germany in this academic movement. And their thought was, since there's laws that try to penalize gay rights and homosexuals of any sort of spectrum, what they would do is they'd make the academic case that gayness, this is their vernacular, gayness was a mental illness. And therefore, it was immoral and in America unconstitutional to create laws against being gay. Now, I want to pause there and just pivot to the crowd and say, does anyone see anything marginally problematic with that approach? Okay. Did they all mean well? Yes. Are the majority of individuals who back then, these organizations were called homophile organizations. The gay as a mental illness or disease movement was, in their theory, a way of working around the law. Did they all believe that they suffered a mental illness or a disease? History would suggest not so, but they felt that this was the best way to move forward. Other problematic things about this that are relevant to where we're going with this discussion is that this society and a number of initial homophile societies fostered in the 30s and 40s were also very exclusive. For instance, Henry Baker's society only permitted men and only recognized homosexuality. They did not recognize or think bisexuality was a thing. So again, I would pivot to the audience and say, do we see anything marginally problematic with that? Yes, a little bit. So we talk about that because for 1924 forward in America and really around the world, that's the movement. Let's talk about this as a mental illness and skirt it around. So we talk about the 50-year anniversary, and when people talk about the 50-year anniversary of the modern movement and pride, we're actually talking about June 28th, 1969. Considering this recording is taking place on June 27th, that's pretty momentous for us. So, woo, awesome, right? June 28th, 1969 popularly refers to something called the Stonewall Riot or the Stonewall Incident, depending on who you're talking to. And it relates to a bar that catered specifically to lesbian, gay, transgendered, a little more transgendered, and people of color, but it was considered so-called a gay bar in New York City on Christopher Street. And there's a long history of police, law enforcement, and government entities hassling, wrangling, oppressing, shutting down, and rallying up gay bars. The Stonewall riots on June 29th were initiated by a particular law enforcement action. Some attest to an upcoming election. Some suggest it had to do with organized crime. But that's kind of the peripheral. The key part is that a number of people were, the bar was raided, individuals were arrested and apprehended, and over the course of the initial hour or so that this was happening, instead of people generally dispersing and trying to flee the scene and not deal with it, a lot of the bar patrons started to stay around. Both on Christopher Street was also a larger area where lesbian and gay individuals just lived and occupied in general. And so it basically created a large group presence as the police were trying to round people up. Some of the individuals had basically locked themselves in Stonewall. There was a fire set. There's a lot of things happening in these first couple of hours. And the popular story would go that at one point, as some people were incarcerated, a very brave, or come on back. Sorry. A very brave individual, Marsha P. Johnson, threw a bottle or rock, depending on whose account you will go with, that shattered some windows in Stonewall and instigated the more aggressive, basically full-on rioting. Lots of objects thrown at the police, fires are set, and what we do know for sure would happen is that over the course of the next 6 days, there would be ongoing occupations, marches, and people coalescing both around Stonewall, marching up and down Christopher Street. There was a park near Stonewall, which people also gathered. And this marks a very big difference from other police raids that turned into riots. Chicago had one in 1966. San Francisco had one in 1967. But this is the first one that was a sustained multi-day affair. And in November of 1969, both organizations, ad hoc, sort of self-defined organizations, and formal groups, homophile groups, in New York and Philadelphia got together and decided that they were going to commemorate what happened at Stonewall. And at that time, they were going to call it the Christopher Street Liberation Day. And as things began to be organized and the word spread out around, remembering the old vernacular was homophile organizations, word began to spread from the East Coast West that people were going to commemorate this day and this experience. Somewhere along the time, there's a number of different people attributed to this, but as the word spread to honor what happened at Stonewall, people began to want to come up with a name that was beyond Christopher Street Liberation Day. And some of the leading choices had been Gay Power Day. And there's a few different people who are accredited with coming up with this term. Greg Sargent is one of them. There's an individual from a California association, an LA-based association, that felt that calling it the Gay Power Parade would be inaccurate because they felt gays did not have power, not political agency, but they had people power. And so someone coined the term, let's call it Gay Pride Parade. And this marks out a very distinct divergence from the historic approach to gay rights in America. What they were doing, and this was a monumental, bold shift, what they were going to do was not apologize for the sexuality. And that was in the beginning, the sort of, it was focused on lesbian and gay rights. And they were not going to apologize. It was part of this idea of coming out of the closet. But it wasn't even that. It was just, we're not going to apologize. This is not a mental illness. This is not a disease. This is who we are. So the term pride, nowadays we might hear it and think it's synonymous with pride parades and Pride Month and honoring LGBT experiences. But pride was a political choice of political activism that was very critical and important. In the same way that Black Power was a very conscientious movement to the idea of empowering African Americans who were socially disenfranchised, pride was about dismissing shame, dismissing social judgment, taboos, in the hopes of one day building a coalition towards rights and eventually power. So when we talk about gay pride, from 1969 forward, this is a Herculean shift in how it's presented, how it's communicated, and we begin the process of where we are today, where the focus is not just asking to be accepted into society as a condition of sickness, but is insisting, demanding, and taking a position within society without asterisks, without compartmentalization, without apology. So we thought that it was really important to make that distinction as we move forward to understand the history of this movement. With that, it's also important when we're talking about Pride Month to look at some of the nuances within this conversation. And one of those things as a mental health and suicide prevention organization is talking about the impact of mental health within the nuances of identity and orientation. So our first guest tonight is, we're honored, I'm signaling to you already, our first guest tonight is Dr. Ashley Moten from Center on Halsted. And you're going to give a little more details to your background, but Ashley's going to be talking, I'm going to be saying Dr. Ashley a lot. I feel like I'm robbing you if I don't put the doctor in. You earned it. So Dr. Ashley is going to be talking to us about the sort of general overview and the nuances about mental health at the intersection of identity and orientation. So Dr. Ashley, thank you for joining us.
Talking into a mic is weird. I mean, I talk professionally for a living, kind of, but not usually into a microphone, usually just to, like, people. So I'm Dr. Ashley Mullen. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I'm the Associate Director of Behavioral Health at Center on Halsted, which is the Midwest's largest and most comprehensive LGBTQ community center. So we offer behavioral health services. We have community and cultural events. We do HIV testing. We have a youth program. We have a seniors program. We do all of the things. Lots of things happen there. One of which is behavioral health, which is what I'm going to talk about. I also identify as queer, so I'm a part of the community, which is what brought me to mental health and brought me to working at Center. I tried to think about what I was going to say today, and every time I sat down to think about it, I was like, I don't know, it's too many things. So I think when we talk about LGBTQ people and mental health, we have to acknowledge the fact that LGBTQ people are 3 to 4 times more likely to experience a mental illness than the general population is, which is a huge, huge, huge number. And a lot of times when we talk about that, it goes back to that idea that homosexuality used to be in the DSM. We used to see that as a diagnosable mental illness until 1973 when it was removed after a lot of activism on the part of the community. It's not like the American Psychiatric Association woke up one day and was like, actually, you know what? Probably gay people are fine. We should just take this out of our book. That would have been nice, but it's really not the way that it happened. For a very long time, that was the approach because of this idea that if we're mentally ill, then maybe we can get some acceptance. And I think we see this continue to be mirrored in the way in which trans people are still represented in the DSM. So there's still gender dysphoria, which is a change from what it used to be. It used to be gender identity disorder. And the argument is often we need to have it in there for access to surgery so people can access hormones, so insurance will cover services. But really what that ends up doing is it continues to continue this idea that LGBTQ people are mentally ill in some way. And while we do experience mental illness, as all people do, we are not inherently mentally ill because of our identities. When we talk about that statistic of 3 to 4 times more likely to experience mental illness, what that's really about is living in a world that doesn't really like us, that doesn't want us here. It's getting constant messages that we are less than, that we shouldn't take up space, that we shouldn't be visible. It's being reduced to our sexuality. And having our sexuality reduced only to sex, as though our relationships were not big and beautiful and containing multitudes, as we sort of assume straight people's relationships do. And so you end up in this place where trying to navigate mental health concerns and sexuality becomes really complicated. The other thing with this is that being queer when you're first coming out can be super isolating. When we first come out, we come out to ourselves alone, in a place where we wonder, what if I'm not straight? What if I'm not cis? What might that mean? How will that impact my life? And while I hope that it's changing, that there are more and more queer people and little queer kids are getting more and more representation and seeing people who look like them. Like, certainly for me growing up, I had no idea that gay was something you could be. And I was really confused as a kid when I was like, well, what if I like girls? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean that I'm the wrong gender? Does that mean that there's something broken about me? Because there weren't like lesbians or gay people in my social circle. It wasn't until I got to like probably middle school or high school that I even know gay was a thing you could be. And so when we come out in isolation, we experience these feelings internally, it can be really difficult to then voice them, to say them out loud, and to know whether or not when we say them we'll be accepted or rejected. I think with that, it's also really important to remember that if you grow up in many other marginalized identities, you usually grow up in a family that shares that identity with you. They're also of a minority race or a minority religion. You have parents that teach you how to move through the world as someone who's Black or someone who's Muslim. For the vast majority of queer kids, and again, I think this is starting to change, we don't grow up with queer parents. We don't have adults who teach us this is what it means to be a gay person in this world, this is what it means to be trans, these are the things you need to know. And so we have to come out to ourselves and then we have to go out and find community. We have to go out and find people who will teach us queer culture and help us understand what that means. And if you live somewhere like Chicago and you have a place like Center on Halsted, that can be easier. There's a really big, beautiful building that you can go and hang out in. But if you live somewhere like the middle of nowhere in North Carolina, that can be a lot harder. The internet makes it easier. We connect that way. But it's complicated. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because I think I so often talk about this more from the perspective of talking to other mental health professionals about like, what do you need to know to work with LGBTQ people? And often it's just like, we're just like you, and we're also not just like you. It's that complicating piece of like, most of the people I work with come to Center not necessarily because they want to talk about their identity, but because they don't. They want to come and just be seen as a person who's struggling with job loss or the end of a relationship or a mental illness and not have the first response be like, well, what was it like for you when you were coming out? Is your depression about your identity? And it's like, well, I mean, maybe a little, but no, my depression is because I just got fired from my job and I'm unemployed and I don't know what to do about that. And I think our field has progressed a lot and we still have a lot more work to do. And so it remains super complicated.
Thank you so much for jumping in, because there is such a massive, massive field to talk about here. And Conversations Cafes are really about trying to take small bites of these very large topics. And that's why we continuously circle back to them. One of the things that hopefully that we talk about a lot is the number one obstacle to effective suicide prevention and mental health care is silence. And what we define that as a silence of stigma that we describe as social and cultural factors that try to dictate how we express ourselves. So there's different ways that that impacts. And you touched on a few, and I want to sort of push you towards one very specific one, that when we talk about stigma, it kind of creates this mental health monolith, that there's more important and less important, and creates all these compartmentalizations, but there's kind of three specific ways that it impacts. It impacts the individual, you can silence yourself. It impacts as a community because you don't have resources very visible out there. But another nefarious way is that it impacts institutionally. It paints attitudes and postures. And so you kind of walked into it a little bit, but when you were talking, especially teaching other clinicians how to, and maybe elaborate a little bit on what you've seen at that level, that sort of clinical institutional level of how misunderstandings and a lack of knowledge or visibility can impact, you know, this experience of like engaging in a human being who may happen to be gay.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The thing that comes to mind for me with that is thinking back to grad school and the way in which we always had like special topics days. And anyone who's listening to this can't see me doing like the fun air quotes, but we had like special topics days where it's like, today we're going to talk about queer people. And that's all we're going to talk about, just their gay identities. And that's it. Like, they don't also have relationship identities, like they don't also have racial identities, like they don't also have religious identities, like there aren't all of these other things that we need to consider. And we're just going to talk about it on this one special day. And the rest of the year, we're just going to talk about normal people, again with the air quotes, as though like like gay people aren't just out in the world doing things all the time. And so it gets boiled down to this like one tiny little sliver where we have to talk about this one very focused thing. And like for me, being out in grad school and like knowing that the LGBTQ community was the area I wanted to focus, I was the probably annoying student that was always like, but what about the queers? But what about the queers? But what about the queers? When people were talking about like something completely different, we're talking about like childhood sexual abuse. And I'm like, well, but what about the queers? Like, how do we talk about that in this intersection? And a lot of my professors, to give them their due credit, were like, oh yeah, like this thing, or let's talk about that. But that there isn't this integration, that there is this idea that we have to talk about all of these identities as like their own separate special topic, as opposed to just like creating cases and creating conversations that talk about diverse people who come in with all of these identities, and how do we understand them in a broader way so that I don't have to be a special topic, because I'm not. Like, I'm Ashley, I'm a person, oddly enough. And I think like our institutions then hold that up. You know, like at my school, we offer classes. So if you want to specialize in working with LGBTQ people, you can. You can take classes in that, and that's great. But if you don't take those classes, where do you get that information? And so then you end up with me, like four times a year, I do clinical work with LGBTQ clients, an introduction. And a lot of the people who come to that training are like pretty well informed and know a lot of things. But some of them ask questions that I'm just like, how did you graduate? Why don't you know this? Are you seeing queer people? Could you refer them here? Because I'm not really sure what's going on right now. And like, more power to you for showing up and like recognizing that you need this education. But like, also, why didn't your school teach you these things? Like, I'm not sharing groundbreaking, nuanced, tiny little minutiae about like how gay men and lesbians interacted during the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. Like, probably you don't need to know that to just see LGBTQ people, broadly speaking. But like, you need to understand that identity is fluid, and that behavior is not the same as identity, and that like people can have all kinds of sexual experiences that may not align with your narrow definition of that identity label that they've chosen. And I really shouldn't be blowing your mind when I say this. Like, this should just be something you already know.
Well, that's good to know. And before we move into our next guest, because we're gonna hope you stay around for the third part of this. But really, just from your peace of mind, one of the things that also kind of happens, especially with representational discussions, is people sort of put an onus on whomever is in the room that fits that intersection to suddenly become the mouthpiece for the whole group. And I'm kind of wondering, have you ever experienced that from that professional level of catching yourself in a place where like people are like, be our soothsayer, tell us more about the gays. Like, yes. You know,
teach me all the things. Yeah. Tell me all the things I need to know about gay people. Go. You have 5 minutes. I need a lot more than 5 minutes. And I'm going to need a lot more people. I think that happens a lot. I think with any marginalized identity, we often put the onus on the person who holds the identity to then speak for all of those people, as if I, as a white, queer, cisgender woman who is in my 30s, could speak for a black trans man who's in his 60s. Like, we just, like, yeah, we're both part of the LGBTQ community, but we've had vastly different life experiences. I can't speak for him. I wouldn't want to. I don't think he would want me to, probably, wherever he is out in the world. And I think also this idea that that marginalized people are required to provide that education, as if the internet wasn't a thing, as if we couldn't educate ourselves, is also super frustrating. Or the idea that I feel like I get a lot of people wanting to like play devil's advocate. Like, well, I'm just saying, like, can I just ask, like, why do you need a pride parade? I don't know, do you know anything about queer history? That's why. Like, do you worry about walking down the street and holding your spouse's hand? Because I do. Like, I live in Chicago, and I worry about that sometimes. But I'm guessing you, straight person who is having a devil's argument with me, doesn't. And it's complicated because, like, obviously I'm here talking about queer mental health, and, like, I do this for a living. I really like going out and talking about it. But I'm electing to be in that position. I'm choosing this for myself. Today, I knew at the end of the day, after I had work all day, I was gonna come and I was gonna talk about this. And I planned for like when I go home, how I'm gonna take extra care of myself and like build to back up my reserves. And that's very different from like being in a class or being in a meeting and suddenly having someone be like, you look queer, tell me the things. I mean, I do have this very gay haircut, so I can kind of understand, but it's complicated and it's frustrating because on the one hand, like, yay, I'm glad you want to know things. I'm glad you want to educate yourself. But also, like, Google is your best friend. There's, like, tons of resources out there, and you don't have to put the onus on queer people who haven't volunteered for that role to teach you.
That's perfect. And I think we're going to talk even more about allyship closing out. So we'll stop right there with that part. Dr. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Peace to God. And this transition point also, we touched on something that's really salient to talking about when we talk about celebrating Pride Month, is this idea, because it comes up, and I think if you pay attention to the news, you just saw it in Boston, but you get like the little cynical thing about like, why isn't there a straight Pride Parade? And speaking entirely selfishly, as a biracial individual, you've heard it before, like, there's Latino Pride, there's Black Pride, where's the White Pride thing? But it's not good enough to just sort of laugh and dismiss that. It's important to understand structurally exactly where this is coming from. When we talk about stigma, stigma isn't always just reinforcing overtly negative words or making somebody actively feel shame. Sometimes stigma can, at its very best, be unintentional, and it can just be systemic. And what I mean very specifically by that is if you were to observe your society today, when someone says, why is there a gay pride parade? If you were to observe your society, what you will notice is that there is a default in the structure of language and media and marketing and anywhere else you look. And the default is a heterosexual default, that the basic structure of a family, of a human being, whether they're a teen, older individual, a younger individual, whether you're looking at a car commercial, a piece of literature, a corporate instructional video on how to flip a burger, the default is consistently heterosexual. And when you hear a term like cis, what they're talking about is someone who identifies as male or female, and from the exterior aesthetic, you would presume is that male or female, okay? That's the default. And so if you map that out, 52 weeks, 365 days a year, without anyone actively doing anything about it, that becomes a default sort of depiction of society. Now, if someone says, hey, you know what? There's a different flavor other than that vanilla. And someone says, no, there's only vanilla. Eventually, the people who have a different flavor other than, who want a different flavor other than vanilla, may go from saying, hey, there's other different flavors, to being more aggressive about there are different flavors, to finally being like, we don't give a shit what you say about vanilla, we're bringing the Neapolitan and it's happening. Yes, I'm using ice cream as an allegory for gay pride, but this is effectively the point of pride, that's lightning and thunder and the truth, that's the point of any sort of cultural or ethnic, or in this case, organic movement. When we're talking about pride, the idea is to insert this into the default, to no longer make it bifurcated. So using one month as Pride Month is not to say, okay, now is when we talk about gays, and then we're silent the rest of the month. It's supposed to be the entry party into a topic that should be talked about year round. And it's important when you engage other people who might say, why don't we have a straight pride parade? You can make the joke, well, every day is straight pride parade. But the very specific mechanisms there is understanding that the default posture, even if it isn't biased or prejudice or bigotry, the default posture is this idea of what they would call heteronormative. So even saying normal, and you don't mean it negatively, you're not trying to judge someone, even if you say, well, normal, and then there's gay, if you are gay, that is stigmatizing. And you didn't have to have any harmful or negative intent behind it. So that's giving people the benefit of the doubt that they mean well. But it's important to understand that because Hope for the Day's central mission in dispelling stigma isn't just on mental health, it has to be in all the factors that are origins of mental health challenges.
and not being able to talk about your mental health has a direct intersection with someone feeling shame for their identity or for their sexual orientation. So it's an immovable reality that as an organization, we need to responsibly call those out. However, not everything is a pretty rainbow. So in 1969, when we start with the Pride Parade, it was primarily promoted as celebrating lesbian and gay pride. However, we know that when it comes to representation and visibility, I go back to the ice cream thing, all right? Even if you have your vanilla, there's butter pecan, there's Rocky Road, there's moose tracks, there's a little bit of vanilla and things. There's far more different flavors. And so when we talk about the idea of sexual orientation and gender identity, there's far more to a spectrum than just female as lesbian and male as gay. And getting that vibrancy into this movement of pride has also been a process. So our next guest is going to be talking about the spectrum, when we talk about pride and representing the spectrum, is a Hope of the Day surrogate and advocate, Gracie Fisher. Please come on up, Gracie. So Gracie, why don't you give us a little background and then jump right in.
Thank you. My name is Gracie. I work with Hope for the Day. I am a part of the education team. I've been with Hope for the Day since I was a little scrawny, annoying teenager. I'm an undergraduate student in neuroscience at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and I'm also a proud bisexual woman. Took me a couple years to get to that point, but I'm here and I'm very happy about it. Happy Pride Month. And today I'll be kind of just discussing a little bit about what we call the pantheon or the spectrum of pride. And that ties directly from what Carl was saying about when we talk about pride, we do not only want to talk about cis, white, lesbian, and gay people, because that is nowhere near the entirety of the spectrum and the diversity that the LGBTQ plus community truly holds. When we talk about Stonewall and we discuss the riots, we had a picture earlier up on our screen of Marsha Johnson, who was a trans woman of color, an African-American transgender woman, and she is often known as the first participant of the Stonewall riots to pick up the brick, the bottle, the rock, whatever, and throw it in response to the brutality that members of the Stonewall were facing. And so that in and of itself is a great example of the diversity that we have in Pride and in the LGBTQ community. So when we discuss Pride and we discuss the issues that come with heteronormativity, cis heteronormativity within the general culture, we also need to distill that down to what that looks like in the LGBTQ community. And we would discuss that. We also want to make sure to bring up the entire spectrum of the LGBTQ community. Tonight, we're all going to be making little fun buttons that say, I am proud to be blank. You get to fill it in with whatever you want. I filled mine in with bisexual because that's a really big part of my identity. It's who I am. It's who I love, etc. And you often hear the term bisexual erasure in the LGBTQ community. And a lot of people might not understand completely what that means or what that is, but when we discuss bisexual erasure, then we're also discussing what it means when, you know, say you have a woman who grows up and, thank you, Carl, woman who grows up and says, oh, I think I like girls. Oh God, I must be a lesbian. What do I do now? A couple years later, oh man, I think I like guys too. Am I really straight? I really can't seem to figure it out. Skipping over the whole idea of there's more to the LGBTQ community than just that binary, including bisexuality, pansexuality, and then we can even get into asexuality, demisexuality, etc. And then also when we talk about the binary, discussions of gender and gender identity come in. And we've had a lot of, I might say, kind of like bumps in the road in this country over the last couple of years when trying, that's a bit of an understatement. Yeah, you can laugh. You know, truthfully, we see it all over the news. We see every day how transgender people, gender nonconforming people, especially when we talk about people of color in the transgender and gender nonconforming community, are constantly exposed to violence. In fact, they are transgender women of color experienced some of the most violence and discrimination. We have dozens of murders specifically of those individuals in this country every year. When you hear people say something along the lines of, oh, I don't understand why I have to learn all your terms. Can't you all just be gay and like the nuances don't matter? They do matter when you're talking about not only somebody's pride and their identity and who they are, but they matter when you're talking about somebody's mental health and their physical and emotional safety, whether it be from partners or strangers, etc. I often think about the whole idea of what Ashley said earlier. You know, I fear walking down the street holding the hand of the person I love. Do you have to do that, straight white man? I don't think so, but yeah. And along with our presentation, we have some really cool photography that can fit along with the image of kind of the umbrella, the spectrum of the LGBTQ community. Yeah, it's really exciting coming up and growing up as a queer person in this upcoming, I guess I could say generation, upcoming couple decades, because even though there is still an insane struggle, and especially when it comes to the struggles of people of color or transgender, gender nonconforming people, you know, struggles that I, as a cisgender bisexual white woman, will never know and never understand, we're still coming to a head of people beginning to look at the LGBTQ community with a little bit less, I think disgust might be a good word. When it comes to discrimination against the LGBTQ community, I often hear the word disgust coming from people outside the community passing their judgments on those within the community. It's really exciting to see how the diversity of the LGBTQ community is kind of finally being recognized by the rest of the community as we begin to allow more people of color and people who fall on different areas of the gender identity spectrum coming into what we're doing.
That's great. Thank you, Gracie, for sharing that. One of the things we're going to draw home and touching on spectrum and having someone who's lived through that experience is understanding, I'm going back to this idea of stigma and the different ways that it impacts individuals and different levels. And when we talk about the spectrum, there's something really important to understand that sometimes, especially marginalized people, if there's division or conflict or not consensus on a movement or a vision of what a movement should look like, there can be an attitude of not wanting to air dirty laundry kind of a thing. So you don't see these discussions. But as a part of recognizing stigma and being able to push through that for the benefits of mental health, this idea of spectrum is a good touchstone to be able to understand that there are no singular experts. When we talk about pride movement, it did start out primarily with a focus on lesbian and gay, meaning male and female, female like in female and male like in male, in all sorts, aesthetically, biologically, everything like that. And why it's important to understand that is that it would take people within the community competing and challenging what was seen as status quo. More important, when we talk about trans individuals, people of color, talk about people who don't fit into one box or another. So we're talking about people who are bisexual, we're talking about people who may be asexual. When we talk about gender dysphoria, that also includes a wide level of individuals who may not ever be in the process of looking at alternative surgeries and things like that for them to recognize themselves as trans. Each one of these elements of making sure they're included when we talk about pride as part of the bigger picture of understanding that the biggest obstacle to our own mental health sometimes are people trying to dictate what is status quo, what is normal, even inside of a movement where we're trying to gain acceptance into the default society. And it's important to understand that, because if we're going to sort of dispel stigma and move beyond it, the key factor that changes everything from any sort of spectrum of mental health, especially within this idea of the pride movement, is the more you start to listen to individuals' experiences and the more you start to respect the agency of the individual voice and stop trying to dictate and prescribe what is or what isn't, you see mountains move. When somebody says, you know what, this depiction isn't fully me and this is what I am, instead of combating that or saying, well, no, you're wrong, get in the box, go along with this movement, what sometimes might be called like the politics of politeness is sometimes the way, there's another fancier word for it, but whenever people try and say like, no, don't deviate from this one thing, stay in this box, you end up in a system that just continues to perpetuate these ideas of stigma. So one of the most important things that we want to advocate for is this idea that the most powerful tool for progression is being able to respect the dignity of the individual experience, being able to trust that even inside of a community, like the LGBT community, everyone is not a monolith. Everyone is not the same. Where I was prefacing with Dr. Ashley, where you might have ended up in an area where people are thinking of you as the spokesperson among all queer people, a big thing we'd want to drive home for the audience listening here and at home is this idea of respecting the dignity of the individual. Just because we're talking about LGBT right now, and just because you heard Dr. Ashley, just because you're Gracie, and you're going to hear from our next guest, that does not mean you've read the whole book on the queer experience, okay? You take that individual experience as something to appreciate and respect, but it's part of being able to trust in people's agency. So the more individuals you listen to and the more you trust in what they're saying instead of just looking for things that meet up with your narrative, the more we do a better job of breaking down the stigma. So that's one sort of recommendation approach to this idea. But this is leading me into the next thing of, all right, so we want to respect agency and we want people to share their own voices and not just assume that just because there's an identifying name to this community, LGBTQ plus, does not mean that any one person speaks for everyone. We want to listen to everyone in there. If you are not inside of that community, how can you be supportive? How can you be an ally, which is the popular term for being someone who's not a dick to the marginalized group, is my non-academic approach to that. So our next guest is Crystal Bazin from Be Super Initiative. You're gonna give us a little more. Please come up. Let me say hi to Crystal.
Hi.
If you feel comfortable, please tell us a little bit about yourselves. But we're going to be talking about allyship and how to support that and support the community.
All right, cool. My name is Crystal. I run the organization Be Super, which uses comic book characters and sci-fi characters to educate people on social injustice. So I'm at a lot of comic book conventions. I speak on a lot of panels. We do after-school programs too, and I've taught, like, I've guest lectured at college campuses and stuff. A little bit about me. I have, like, really intense anxiety and go to therapy and all that fun stuff. It's not fun, but, like, I joke about it to make it seem okay, because it's still, there's still such that, like, narrative where, that we need to eradicate. But that's how I can like talk about it. And also like I'm queer. So, you know, we're queer, we're here, we're fabulous. There is more that goes along with that chant at protests, but I don't know if I can really swear. Okay. It's like, we're queer, we're here, we're fabulous, don't fuck with us, is like one of the big chants. But I'm also like an activist and organizer in the city, and I identify as like a socialist as well, and that's also really important to me. And so when it comes to the term ally, I have like a complicated relationship with it, because there's a lot of me that hates the term ally. And there's a lot of me that's like, no, we need people outside the community and in the community to speak up and be as loud as possible. So the part of me that like doesn't like that terminology is that it's become like people themselves can be like, I'm an ally. I know more than you. Like, you might be queer, but I know more. And I've gotten that so much. Like, from so many people. That's not like shocking, but they're like, well, I'm an ally, so I understand. And it's similar for like any other marginalized group. Well, I have a black friend, so I understand. Well, I have this, so I understand. Well, I have a daughter, so I definitely know about the women's movement. Like, you know, and I'm like, that doesn't equate to you. Wait, what? So there's a lot there. I think that those communities get to deem if you're an ally or not. But also, that term is also within the community. There's a lot of people in the community that don't see other people in the community themselves. And that's also something like what Grace was talking about, but the bi erasure. That's huge. I didn't know my identity, especially like in high school. I was like, well, I'm attracted to, you know, women and men, but I can't like, but I only knew the terms lesbian and gay. And I was like, well, I'm just weird then. Like, I'm nothing. Like, what is this? And it wasn't until college when I actually learned more about it that I'm like, oh, there's more than just that. That's great. But so there's a lot of nuances with that. And also, I think when it comes to the term ally, whether you're in the community or outside the community or anything like that, you don't get to pick and choose what part of the community you show up for. You're not like, I'm definitely there for, like, you know, Boys Town. But, like, gay cis men that are white, I'm there for, I will show up. But lesbians, no. Mm-mm. No, like, you don't get to pick and choose. Like, you have to be there for black and brown lives. You have to be there for trans lives. You have to be there for immigrants, for people who are undocumented, because there's queer people there too. Like, there's queer people in every community that you can think of. You also have to be there for people that have disabilities, whether that is, like, as obviously we're talking about mental health, but that's also physical. And disabilities that you cannot see. And so it's like a much more broad thing than someone just posting on their Twitter bio, I'm an ally to this community. It's a lot more than just that. And as both the panelists before have said, like, there are Google, there are books out there. There are a lot of books out there. There are a lot of bookshops out there. There are a lot of people out, like, there's public libraries. You can go, like, use a computer at a public library to figure out this stuff out. You don't have to be like, I need to find a queer. Where's a queer? I need to sit them down and have a 6-hour conversation with them to understand. So, yeah.
And that's a perfect starting point, because before we go into the activity, we're going to use this as an opportunity to help others who might listen and maybe they questions to kickstart their Google exploration. Mm-hmm. There's a few sort of like operating decorum that I would like to hear, you know, Dr. Ash and Gracie, feel free to jump in as well. So the first thing I'm going to start with sort of the, I almost said, well, let me be a devil's advocate. But, so what I'm going to start with sort of baseline things, because I think it's important. You want to give people the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. So let's talk with language semantics first. So people, we said terms like cis, and we haven't jumped into talking about pronoun identification, too, but you sure as we're sitting here, we know there's a popular, well, it's he and it's she and it's them and it's there and I don't get it. And that might have been, you know, using a Southern accent might have been stigmatized too. So let me use my normal voice. What is the difference between those? I'm not asking you to answer that part. So this idea of asking about cis and different and gender pronouns and all this kind of stuff. Yes, we would say, well, Google what that means. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to hear from your voice point the relevance and importance. So I'm not asking you to define cis and that, but sort of talk about, let's start with gender pronouns. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the, you know, the relevance of that. So not he or she, don't.
Such
define
big
it, like,
questions. Yeah. I think that if someone really does want to learn, like, there's differences within that too. And like, there's some very toxic things about call out culture that like also stops people from asking questions, even though they might be very sincere and really do want to learn. When it comes to like pronouns and stuff like that, I mean, there's more than just like she, her, he, him, they, there's also Z, there. Some people don't even use pronouns. They just prefer their name and that's that. I think when it comes to that, it's definitely like a learning kind of curve for some people who've never experiencing that kind of thing. But I think that like, for me, when I go into a new space, especially if I'm speaking or anything like that, and I'm not an anxious mess like before this, I usually go up and talk to people and I just say my pronouns. And I have a hard time with also the phrase preferred pronouns, because that means that you could call them something other than what they prefer. But like, just my pronouns. This is my pronouns. Or like, hey, like, my name's Crystal. I use she, her pronouns. I know a lot of people at my therapist signs all of the emails exchange we have with Zara's pronouns. And so, like, that is, like, definitely a thing where I was like, cool, great. I know what my therapist's pronouns are. But there is definitely, like, a thing where I try to push that as much as I can about just saying what my pronouns are, even though people would assume that by looking at me, but I don't want people to assume anymore. And that's not just on the people who are gender nonconforming, trans and stuff like that, on their plates to be like, well, these are my pronouns. It's on everyone to be like, well, these are my pronouns, so that we kind of normalize that. That's my thought.
I agree. And I'm realizing as you're saying that I didn't say my pronouns, so shame on me. My pronouns are she, her. I think the other thing that, like, always comes up in this conversation where there's that, like, push-pull between, like, do you educate yourself? Do you ask someone? How do you know when to ask someone? How do you know when to go to Google? I think it's also important to remember that, like, people can tell what your intent is in asking. And there's a big difference between, you seem so fascinating, tell me everything. And, like, I'm not sure I entirely understand what you mean. Can you tell me more about that? Like, there's a huge difference between saying, like, I don't get this pronoun thing, can you explain it to me? And being like, oh, I've never heard of Z in here as pronouns, can you help me figure out how to use them? And so I think that is something we have to keep in mind too, because for better or worse, we tend to fall into those two, like, dichotomous spaces of, like, either it's all on you or it's all on queer people, and it's like a continuum. And there are some questions which, like, I would always rather someone ask me than Google maybe, but there are also some questions where it's like, you don't know what the word cisgender is. The internet is a thing. Please type it into Google. You will have a lovely definition. And so I think also, like, using some common sense, when I'm doing, like, education for therapists and talking about how do you figure out what questions to ask and what questions not to, I always want people to start with, why are you asking that question? Like, are you asking it because you're just, like, fascinated and curious? You probably don't need the answer then. Or are you asking because you feel like you need this information to do a better job of communicating with this person or understanding where they're coming from? Run that question through the other direction. If it's something you're asking a queer person or a trans person, is it something you would ask a straight person or a cis person? When did you first know that you were gay? Sounds really weird when I say, when did you first know that you were straight? Right? So, like, if you can flip it and it still sounds like a reasonable question to ask someone, then it's probably okay. So I think, like, being really thoughtful about that and knowing that it's okay to ask questions, like, especially of queer people that you have established relationships with, just being thoughtful about what questions and in what context, and do people have the option of opting out of those conversations if they're like, look, I just did this really awesome podcast and now I'm just tapped out on talking about queer things for the rest of the day, you know?
We're going to stick on stay on time for everything. What I'd like to do is just reiterate, especially for listeners and those live, something that Dr. Ashton, you were excellent to talk about, and Gracie brought up, and Crystal has brought up over and over again. Whether we call it LI or just trying to be supportive to people and population planet, one of the most powerful things you can do to support that advocacy is, again, can't stress this enough, is instead of looking at any one individual, your friend that you know, a family member or what have you, instead of looking at them as your Obi-Wan or Yoda of that intersectional experience, especially when we're talking about queers, it actually shows a great deal of respect if you take a moment to sit down and do some independent research. There's a time and a place to sort of talk about what you may have learned or picked up on the internet. Probably need to vet your sources. But in terms of this idea of alliance, I want to pivot to Dr. Ashley to give us the closing words on it.
Well, I was going to say, like, we also say, like, go Google things, go look at things, and, like, that can sound really dry and academic. I'm not saying go sit down and read, like, a tome on gender history. Like, go watch Gentleman Jack on HBO.
All
like,
right, there you go.
Find media, books, and TV shows and movies that represent queer people and watch them. Like, the easiest way to learn about queer people without making queer people teach you is to consume the media that we create that accurately represents our lives. Go watch Pose. Like, if you want, like, watch the first season of Pose. If you want a study on what the AIDS epidemic looked like for black and brown people in the 80s, like, A, it's a beautiful show. B, who wouldn't want to look at Billy Porter? Yes, okay. I was like, is that his name? Billy Porter. And see, like, it's a fun way, an interesting way, an engaging way to learn about history. So, like, it doesn't have to be this dry academic go take a queer studies class. It can also be, like, watch this fun movie.
And I think that's a perfect way of closing out before we go into our activity tonight. I said it at the start, and I'm just going to reiterate it again, is the idea that, again, small bites of very large topics, and why we focus on pride today specifically instead of going through talking about acronyms and going through different sorts of definitions is because we want people to understand and appreciate that this is a socio-political movement, a conscientious effort to insert a necessary voice into population. Gay people are freaking real, right? So, you know, it's not an aberration or in people's imaginations. And it's exactly parallel and conducive to every other sort of necessary rights movement that's existed in this country and worldwide. And that could make people uncomfortable. That can make African Americans uncomfortable. You say gay rights movement is just the same as the black rights movement. The body counts, unfortunately, for not respecting that are the same, you know, in terms of it's brutal and it's violent and it's repressive. So the most important takeaway I want you to have from this idea of celebrating the power and history of pride is that the most powerful thing you can do, both as an ally or someone within the community, is to explore and listen to and validate and value lived experience. Whether it comes through media and movies or somebody's fictional or non-fictional book, it's a YouTube show or something you're Googling, or just someone you know, letting someone tell you their experience, tell you their story, and taking it as equal measure. You don't need any further validation. They don't need to be your significant other, your mother, your father, your daughter, your sister, or anyone, for it to be very real and impactful. That's probably one of the most powerful things you can do, even if you're inside of the community. Being able to listen to other people's voices, even if it deviates from your experience, is one of the most powerful ways that we dispel stigma. We help build an environment that is ultimately healthier for everyone. And at the end of the day, Hope for the Day's interest is not in who you're having sex with, but if you are healthy before, during, and after with the sex. Which is a weird way to clip this off because it's not about sex at all, right? But that's kind of our point, is that the human experience is bigger than just these terms that we put. But we have to learn how to live with these terms in our own agency to get to that reality. So with that, we have a little closing activity for everyone here, both actively watching or chilling in the shop. Our friends, our homies,
Busy Beaver Button Company.
Busy Beaver Button Company has dedicated a whole bunch of resources for us to make our own custom buttons. What they say is, I am proud to be, and you get to insert, draw some pictures, some colors of what you're proud to be. And why we're doing this, if everyone remembers what I talked about at the start, normalization is part of breaking down that stigma. And owning pride and being an immigrant, owning pride and being lesbian, gay, queer, trans, one in pride in being black, one in pride in being Latino, Latina, Latinx, anything you want is part of being within the same community but having your own distinct individuality. So this activity is real simple. We want you to designify a button for you, and we also have a little hang-up wall we're going to be putting up at SIP as we encourage people to make buttons as they come throughout the next couple of weeks. So if you'd like, come and get your little template here. Draw some things. Draw some things, and we'll get your button pressed right over there in the corner of the bar.
I hope you have the button.
Otherwise, if you're going to take this moment to chill and peace out, we cannot thank you enough for joining Conversations Cafe. This episode, Living Out Loud, celebrating the history and power of Pride Month, again, was presented by American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Banyan Treatment Center, Dark Matter Coffee, hosted here at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar. And we can't thank all of our amazing guests, Dr. Ashley, Crystal, Gracie.
Hell yeah.
Thank you all for your wonderful voices. This thank episode you, will be posted next week. You all have been wonderful. Have a great night, everybody. Let's make some buttons.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.